Next case for argument is Hofslein v. Barnhart. Another Miss Borowski with a different first name? Sisters? Well, and anyway, Miss Borowski, you're up.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Violet Borowski, counsel for the plaintiff, Hofslein.
So you're the sister? The sister. Twin?
Twins.
Right. Okay.
Despite the fact that four examining physicians whose opinions were supported by neuropsychological testing and MRI found that Hofslein was disabled, the ALJ, without a basis in substantial evidence, rejected these opinions and the district court affirmed. Dr. Peck, Dr. Wegel, Dr. Zontag, and Dr. Bordeaux all found that Hofslein was disabled, and all the other doctors in the record, including the state agency physician's opinions, are not inconsistent with Dr. Peck, the treating physician's opinion. Thus, the ALJ should have afforded controlling weight to the treating physician, Dr. Peck, when making her determination. Substantial evidence does not support the ALJ's determination to give greatest weight to the medical expert, Dr. Callier, at the hearing, as Dr. Callier's only contact with Hofslein was at the hearing. The ALJ reasoned, and erroneously reasoned, that Dr. Callier should have been afforded the greatest weight because he had the opportunity to review the entire record and was familiar with Social Security Disability Program requirements. While it is the ALJ's duty to weigh the evidence, she still must follow the rules and regulations. SSR 96-2P, 96-6P, and 404-1527 do not support the ALJ's determination to grant greater weight to the medical expert than to the treating physician.
But the ALJ in this case, in this abundance of Social Security cases we have this morning, I think was concerned about what he saw as a disparity between the treatment notes of Dr. Peck and the ultimate conclusion. She seemed to be oriented, cooperative, he says, in his opinion. And so, in the end, the ALJ finds only moderate difficulties in these things, which he then incorporates in his hypothetical. Now, is it your position that even moderate difficulties should be enough to find her disabled?
It is my position that with the great amount of moderates that were found by both the state agency physicians along with the moderates found by the medical expert, that all of these put together would constitute an individual who had severe deficiencies in areas of mental functioning, and together the vocational expert could have come to the conclusion of no work.
Well, I mean, it sounds like moderate plus moderate plus moderate equals severe, I guess, because page 3, we have moderate restriction. This is, again, the ALJ finding moderate restriction in activities of daily living. Moderate difficulties in social functioning is what he finds. The next page, he finds moderate difficulties in maintaining concentration, persistence, or pace. But then he goes on to say the objective testing doesn't support more than a mild degree of limitation. Then he goes on to talk about the neuropsychological testing. So, you know, I guess there's this sense. Here's a woman who had a lot of education, and she certainly, no one says she's trouble-free, but the question at step 5 is there anything she could do? I mean, should we justify this finding of disability? And why doesn't substantial evidence support the ALJ's conclusion that there are things she could do, maybe unattractive things that neither you or nor I nor she, for that matter, would want to, but things she could do?
In order to come to the ALJ's conclusion that substantial evidence supports that she could do some jobs, the ALJ mischaracterized the treatment notes of the treating physician and also gave the wrong significance to the neuropsychological testing. The treatment notes that Dr. Peck had, while he did note the things that the ALJ noted, More frequently, he noted that she was feeling drained and tired, that her speech was pressed, tangential and detail-orientated, that she was a bit verbose, feeling isolated, lacking motivation, fear of interacting with others, had a loss of sense of responsibility, and reduced eye contact and tearful at times. And additionally, her therapist, Scott Phillips, Dr. Wegel, a person that she was sent to for a second opinion based on disability, whose opinion was consistent with Dr. Peck, and Dr. Thomas's notes, were all noted the same things: hyperverbal, tangential, and highly detail-orientated. All these things were noted, yet the ALJ selectively relies on the few instances where she had good eye contact or her appearance, which was never considered not to be, which no doctor found that she had a problem with.
Right, but even so, isn't the ultimate question whether those deficits, if they're properly reported to the vocational expert, prevent her from holding a job in the national economy? This VE identifies 8,000 housekeeping positions, hospital cleaner positions, kitchen helper positions. I mean, if you tend to chat too much, I mean, you can still be, and I don't, you know, if you have sort of rambling discussions, there are people actually with pretty severe disabilities who do housekeeping kinds of functions.
She also noted that at some days she would not be able to perform any tasks. She would be, she would feel as though she'd have to shut down and go into a room. It seems as though any stress of any, if on a bad day she was given a task to do, she couldn't be able to perform it because she would just feel overwhelmed by it and have to shut down. And there's notes by the treating physician that show that on some days she just could not handle the pressure. And actually, at the end, the treating physician was saying that she might have a manic depressive and suggesting possibly medications for that, lithium and dipecotate, because he felt as though she might have those ups and downs, which might explain why some of the notes showed that on some days she was doing better than on other days.
Mm-hmm. And I assume, if asked, the VE would have said if she wasn't going to show up once every 2 weeks, that you couldn't hold a job.
Correct.
I mean, usually they're asked that question.
She was asked if the person was absent once a week, and the VE responded no jobs. And if the person could not complete tasks, then the VE also responded there would be no jobs, which is consistent with Dr. Peck's opinion when he found that she had poor functioning in 8 areas of work-related functioning, and also Dr. Wegel's opinion, who Dr. Peck sent Hofsling to for a second opinion. He also noted those same deficiencies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Borowski. Ms. Brandel?
Good morning. May it please the court, Cynthia Brandel on behalf of Commissioner Barnhart. In this case, the ALJ engaged in thorough consideration and a very thorough discussion of all the record evidence and reasonably relied on the medical expert's opinion regarding Ms. Hofsling's functioning.
You know what I want to ask you about? I mean, in all of these mental disability cases, we are certainly faced with the problem that the diagnosis, I'll just put it nicely, is probably more a matter of art than science. It's not like somebody looks at your leg and says, yep, it's a broken leg, or even does a test to see if you've got the kind of blood cells that would be consistent with leukemia or something of that sort. That's the kind of case where I'm very uncomfortable with an ALJ going back inside the treatment notes of a doctor and saying, you know, I, the ALJ, from the outside, not having sat in on the treatment sessions, not having experienced the care of that patient, am going to second guess the ultimate conclusion that somebody who's a specialist in the area, as Dr. Peck was, has come to. Why doesn't the ALJ have some obligation maybe to say, I don't believe Dr. Peck because nobody else, none of the other specialists agreed with him, but not, I mean, we argue this all the time in terms of deference to a fact finders who say, oh, you know, it was the ALJ who watched the witnesses, it was the ALJ who saw the demeanor. By the same token, it was Dr. Peck who was examining this patient. So why is it permissible for the ALJ to use that as the reason for disregarding Dr. Peck?
Well, I think that was only one of the reasons why the ALJ discredited Dr. Peck's opinion was the fact that it was not well supported by his own treatment notes.
But what if we take that reason away and we say that's just not a good reason? It's really too invasive into the medical diagnosis function. How can we be sure that this reliance on this person who just sits around and reads the record is substantial evidence to support the ALJ's opinion?
Well, as I believe, Judge Wood, you just noted, the Dr. Peck's opinion was inconsistent with that of the medical expert who did review the entire record.
Right, who had never examined her at all, right?
That's correct.
He sits there and reads this cold record that we don't like in other contexts and thinks that he knows.
That's correct. That's the role of the medical expert, to look at all the record evidence. Dr. Peck's opinion was inconsistent with other record evidence, including other record mental health professional opinions, including professionals who did examine Ms. Hofsleen. For example, Dr. Thomas performed a neuropsychological evaluation. He had an MRI administered, evaluated the MRI, and concluded...
Of course, the MRI is going to reveal physical problems inside her brain. It's not going to illuminate any kind of psychiatric condition.
That's correct, but Dr. Thomas also administered a battery of tests and concluded that while there were some unusual test scores on examination of attentional processes and speed of information, that there certainly, his own words, certainly was no indication of a significant impairment. Similarly, Dr. Nye performed a neurology evaluation, and he concluded that Ms. Hofsleen's attention span and concentration, use of language and her fund of knowledge, her orientation, recent and remote memory, all things related to the ability to work, Dr. Nye found that these were all normal and appropriate for her age and education level.
Right, but is that inconsistent with a person suffering from depression who one day out of three just can't get out of bed? You know, if you happen to get the two good days, her language will be fine, her function will be fine, she'll be able to carry on a conversation with you. I just wonder how probative it is as to the type of psychiatric disorder that Dr. Peck was trying to describe.
Well, in this case...
Dr. Peck probably wouldn't have said that she has problems with, you know, vocabulary either.
Right. In this case, the ALJ found that Ms. Hofsleen could perform a very narrowly tailored and very specific range of work. And in doing so, granted she may have good and bad days, but finding that she could perform this very narrow range of work based on a medical expert's opinion minimized her problems that she reported, her problems with stress, her problems in dealing with other people.
What is the current status of the treating physician rule? How much weight does he get?
Well, the treating physician is usually entitled to controlling weight. However,
Still a rule after all these years?
Yeah. Well, not the case, yes, but however,
why?
It's not entitled... excuse me? Pardon me?
Oh, I don't understand. I never understood this rule. Why should he be given particular weight?
Because the treating physician is the treater and spends the most time and is usually aware of all the treatment that an individual has received.
Well, that would come out in his evidence, right? So, but why would his status as a treating physician, as opposed to the amount of time he'd spent with the patient and how much he knew and so on, why wouldn't that be what you'd be interested in?
I thought this rule, I mean, although it's cited in these briefs, has this big giant if in the front of it that basically says if everything else checks out, then we're going to give the treating physician his opinion controlling weight. But, of course, that's the same thing as saying we don't give the treating physician controlling weight, because by the time you've satisfied the if, you've already made the inquiry. It's an oddly phrased rule.
And, of course, what tugs the other way is that a treating physician is more likely to lean in favor of the patient in terms of diagnosis.
Yes, it, as the medical expert at the hearing recognized.
But that's just another way of, you know, raising, does this treating physician rule have any significance, or is it just some rote recitation that people have grown accustomed to without actually thinking about it?
Well, I think it has significance, but as...
Why?
In the weight to be given to the various physician opinions of record, it's not a blanket rule, as Judge Wood recognized.
Why give it any weight?
Well, the ALJ is required to weigh all the record physician opinions.
Oh, no, I don't mean any weight. Why give any weight to the status of a physician? Why not look at what he says, how much time he spent with the patient, and so on?
Well, I think the ALJs do that in recognizing the status of a treating
physician.
But
then you're saying the rule is empty.
No, I don't think I'm saying
that. All you care about is what the treating physician did, not that he's called the treating physician, right?
Well, yes, it's certainly significant what the treating physician did and what he said and why
he's
saying it.
Well, what if the treating physician had been treating her for 2 days? Would he be given any weight?
Well, I don't think so, because...
Right, of course. That shows there's no treating physician rule.
Well, he wouldn't qualify as a treating physician.
Why not?
Because he would not have a perspective of the patient's longitudinal history.
No, he's her treating physician. He may be the only physician she's ever had. The point is, it's not being a treating physician that gives your testimony weight. It's what you've actually done. How long, how much you know, your expertise, and all that.
And I would just follow up. You quote this on page 21 of your brief, where actually, it's not quite a quote, but I assume it's an accurate paraphrase. In order to be entitled to, quote, controlling weight, a medical opinion must be rendered by a treating source, must be well supported by medically acceptable clinical and laboratory diagnostic techniques, and also must not be inconsistent with other substantial evidence in the record. I mean, having said all of that, I don't know what you have left, actually. I mean, you ought to embrace that, because you don't want us to look at Dr. Peck's evidence anyway.
Yes, but in this case... but in this case, Dr. Peck's opinion is not entitled to controlling weight because it was not well supported and it was inconsistent with other substantial evidence in the record.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Brandel. Ms. Borowski, how much time does she have? 3 minutes?
Dr. Peck's opinion should be given controlling weight because it was, in fact, consistent with the evidence in the record. He treated her for over 2 years prior to the hearing once a month. He referred her to several different specialists, which shows that he wasn't just trying to help her and say that she's disabled because he knows her, but he actually sent her for a second opinion and to Dr. Wegel, who also found that she was disabled, another psychiatrist. He then sent her for neuropsychological testing. He also sent her to a therapist. All these things show that he was not only did he have knowledge of all the information in the record, but that he wasn't just giving an opinion.
See, that's fine, but you can say all those things without referring to his status as a treating physician or giving weight to that. He's just someone who spent a lot of time with her and whose evidence is therefore entitled to weight. But why? Isn't that all you're saying?
Regardless of his status, what his title is, the evidence shows that Dr. Peck has the most familiarity and with this individual, and that his opinion is consistent with all the other evidence. He's aware of everything else in the record, and he's the person that would have the best knowledge of her impairments. The medical expert only saw her at the hearing. When asked why his opinion was different from the treating physician, he just said, well, sometimes treating physicians don't see everything in the record. And then when asked by the attorney, is your opinion specifically speaking about Dr. Peck, he said, no, I'm just generally speaking. Sometimes treating physicians don't really see everything in the record, or sometimes they're trying to help their patient. In this case, the ALJ seems to rely on that without really recognizing the fact that Dr. Peck didn't fall into that generalization that the medical expert was giving. In fact, Dr. Peck met every requirement underneath the controlling physician rule, and he did see everything in the record.
So because he was the referring physician,
he was
right?
a referring yeah. physician, so he would have received the reports afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, counsel mentioned that the work was such a narrow range of work that the vocational expert ended with. However, it doesn't address the fact that she doesn't have the sustained ability to work 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. Dr. Peck's opinion, along with all the other doctors that found her disabled, found that on certain days she would be worse off than other days. And so an individual who could not predict when she couldn't come to work and when some days would need to seclude herself from everyone else would not be able to work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Borowski and Ms. Brandel. Next case.